Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts. WSECU's goal is to help make the right card make a difference. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
The thing that always set me apart from other comedians is I've always been able to do any voice that I hear. And I got that ability by circumstance. And this is not a joke. This is a true story. Everyone in my family is deaf.
Hey, it's Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is comedian Craig Gass. He lives in New York now, but he grew up in Seattle.
Growing up in a deaf family, I couldn't learn how to speak from my family. I learned how to speak by copying all the voices I heard on TV. And never got an accent from the Bronx, which is where I'm originally from. And everybody in the Bronx sounds like Tracy Morgan. Everybody in the Bronx talk like this, whether you black or white, male or female. That's crazy. That's crazy. Hey, this is the voice of your next door neighbor, and I'm a Vietnamese girl. That's crazy.
That is crazy, right? Or is it? To Craig, this was just life. Well, today on the show, our theme is what is normal? How that idea of normalcy can be a comfort or a burden or an elusive, shape-shifting something in between. So let's return to Craig Gass now. And a heads up, this story does contain a slightly off-color PG-rated joke.
So the weirder the voice, the easier it is for me to do it. Like Christopher Walken has a real stop and go kind of voice where he'll talk every once in a while. He'll stop. And then he'll keep going. So it became this like superpower I had. And as a result, I started working with Bob Rivers and Twisted Radio here in Seattle. And that led to me putting a tape together for Howard Stern. Howard had me start working on his show immediately to do celebrity phone calls on his show. And I would call in as Sam Kinison, calling in live from the gates of hell with somebody who, like Jeffrey Dahmer. When Jeffrey Dahmer passed, the next morning, I was on the air as Sam Kinison, calling live from the gates of hell. Hey guys, this is Sam Kinison. And I'm down here with Jeffrey Dahmer. He just made it down here. He's already got his own cooking show. And he's looking at me like my butt is a T-bone! Oh! Oh! Yeah, so it was really crazy.
So when do you remember becoming aware that this was not the normal family structure?
That's the interesting thing is that my whole life people would go, oh my God, how that is so weird. Wasn't it weird? And it's not. It's the way you grow up is the way you grow up. There's always a sensitivity that people have that's unnecessary about being around me and thinking, oh, I don't want to say anything that might be inappropriate. Meanwhile, the most inappropriate jokes I've ever heard in my life about deaf people were from my deaf family. My sister, a couple years ago, at dinner, my sister is sitting across the table from me and she's signing to me in sign language. And she said, do you want to hear a good joke? And I said, sure. And then she said, me too. And I was like, oh my God. Yeah, that was awesome.
Well, a lot of people, a lot of comics grow up making their family members laugh, mm-hmm. making their parents laugh, trying to get approval in that way. So did you do that? And if so, did you have to learn how to craft sign language jokes?
Well,
or
it's
physical
fun.
Humor.
It's really funny you bring that up because I would do impressions for my family that involved no voices. I just did impressions of body language. Here's grandpa standing out on the balcony. And then I would do impression of grandpa, like just kind of standing there, like fumbling through his change on the balcony, whatever. I did impressions of people that involved zero voices. And whenever I do an impression now, I always think of the person more than the voice. And it's been pretty weird because over the years, everyone who I do an impression of has tried to meet me, and it always leads to like a funny conversation.
Have you met Tracy Morgan?
A million times.
Yeah.
And he's insane. And I love him. I'll tell you, the last time I saw Tracy, I hadn't seen him in a while, and his opening act sees me. I'm at a show that he's doing, his opening act sees me and goes, "Hey, does Tracy know you're here?" And I go, "No, I just walked in." He goes, "Oh man, Tracy gonna be so excited." And Tracy walks off stage. I'm standing off to the side of the stage, and the crowd is cheering for him. And Tracy starts walking by. His opening act goes, "Tracy, look who's here. It's Craig Gass from New York." And Tracy looks at me. I haven't seen him in over a year. He walks by and he goes, "Craig, you know why my hands are so smooth?" And I go, "What?" "You know why my hands are so smooth?" And I go, "I don't know why." And he goes, "Because they always counting money and rubbing girls' booties." And he walked away. And I went, "Okay, good to see you, Tracy." Like, that was such a, what the hell was that?
Do you ever, when you have performed with him, opened for him or whatever, do you do your impression of him?
Here's the crazy thing. Tracy Morgan knows there's a comedian out there by the name of Craig Gass who does an impression of him. And he's always talking about that guy. And then when he sees me, he seems to identify me as somebody he's met once. And he never correlates the two.
Can you remember times growing up or whatever when you just kind of were confronted with something that was different for you because of the family you grew up in?
I know that I would hit circumstances where, well, we can't approach that the same way because my family's deaf, which I got to say, let me get away with murder. When I was a kid, I was always a class clown. It wasn't intentional, but I would really test the patience of my teachers. And it would always get to a point where they'd go, "Okay, we need your mom to come to school and talk to your principal and your teachers about your behavior." And I'd go, "All right, well, she's deaf, so you need an interpreter. And I know sign language." So I would sit there in front of all my teachers and my principal, and I would lie and edit on the fly as they would look at my mom and they'd go, "Okay, tell your mother that the reason why you're here is because you are having some behavior problems." And I'd look at my mom and go, "So," and I'd start signing, "they're saying that although they think I'm a very good student, there's some small issues we need to work on." And my mom would shake her head like, "Okay." And they'd look at her and go, "Okay, now tell her." And I was lying right in front of my teachers. So there were special circumstances where I found myself being put in a position where I could have control over my destiny.
Yeah. Do you think that growing up with your version of normal has taught you anything about, you know, how to understand people from different backgrounds and stuff like that and coming to the table with assumptions or baggage or history that might be a lot different from yours?
Absolutely. Another great question, because I've noticed, like, there's a guy that I met here in Seattle named Steve Gleason. He lives in New Orleans. Steve Gleason is a football player, used to play for the New Orleans Saints, and he has ALS. He's now confined to a wheelchair where he communicates through a computer screen where he uses his eyes to put words and sentences together. And I notice the way that people approach Steve is similar to the way that people approach my family. So cautiously and sensitively that it's almost like treating somebody like a child, which is why I always go out of my way to communicate with Steve in a different way, in a way that is more normal. You know, every time I walk up to him and I go, "I know if I get there right now, there's porn on that screen. I know if I walk up to you right now, I'm going to see porn on that screen." Like, I'm always making jokes with him and stuff. And he's one of the funniest guys I've ever met. I remember Steve saying, we ran into each other at a Pearl Jam concert. And he said, "Hey, Craig, can you tell some jokes to my friends?" And I'm telling them jokes. And Steve mentioned, and I never told him the story, Steve said through his computer screen, "Craig's family is deaf. I'll bet that's why he got so good at impressions, because his family is deaf." And I said, "Oh my God, what Steve just said is right. I couldn't learn how to talk from my family. I learned how to talk by copying all the voices I heard on TV." And then Steve typed out, "My kids will probably end up talking like robots." And I was like, "Oh my God, that is hilarious." So yes, you end up seeing the world through in a different way that other people do. And I learned how to laugh.
This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today's show is all about what is normal. Nothing is more normal, more universal than death. Sorry for the downer, but it's going to happen. What is not normal is for young people to die before their parents. This is not the order of how things should go. In this next story, we'll hear about a young man who lost his life too early and the effect it had on his high school shop teacher. It led to a class project that was definitely not on the syllabus. Sound Effect's Jennifer Wing tells us more.
In the basement of Franklin High School in South Seattle, I meet with Zion Mole. He's 18 years old, and he's a senior here. And where are we right now?
In the wood shop where we made a Ryan De La Cruz's casket.
Again, this is where students made a casket last June for Ryan De La Cruz. Ryan was a senior. He died a few weeks before graduating. His plan after high school was to join the Marines. He made things out of wood in this sprawling room full of tree stumps, band saws, and varnish. Mike Lawson was Ryan's woodshop teacher.
He's just a really straight-up kid. And I don't mean that as being derogatory to the kids that I butt heads with.
On this Friday morning, Mike is helping a freshman make a small box. Putting the hinges on is a little tricky. Yes.
If you did this, it would look like it was made by a high school shop student that wasn't trying very hard. So what we're trying to do is make it look like it really should. So
this class is a different, whole different scene. They make a mistake in another class. They don't take care of their business. They might get an E on a term paper or something. In my class, they make a mistake when they're not paying attention or goofing around. They could come out of here with one eye or no eyes or, you know, vastly different configurations of their hands.
Mike is direct with his students, which can be off-putting to some of the kids.
If they're doing something wrong in my class, I say quit around and take care of your business.
This doesn't bother Zion. Mike is one of his favorite teachers.
He's a good mentor too, you know. I used to be late a lot to class. And even though I was late, you know, he'd always help me get my grade back up. And he has a good vibe to him. He's just a good guy.
Zion was Mike's student last spring when 17-year-old Ryan De La Cruz was fatally shot in Martha Washington Park. It's right next to Lake Washington in southeast Seattle.
So last June, they went to the park to go chill and, you know, ghost hunt. You know, ghost hunting, you know, it's just like a little game, you know, playing around, just acting silly, looking for stuff that's not there, you know, just kids having fun. Someone was shooting, and Ryan got hit, and he died.
Death is expensive. Coffins can cost thousands of dollars. Mike wanted to do something to help Ryan's family. They didn't have a lot of money. So when the news came down about what happened, an announcement was made over Franklin's PA system that to help Ryan's parents, Mike was going to build a coffin for Ryan. Anyone who wanted to help was welcome to pitch in after school. It was the difficult students who turned out to do the work, the ones that Mike butted heads with.
It was interesting that this terrible situation that was totally out of the blue that no one expected was the linchpin that kind of brought this whole group together I never would have said I would have spent my afternoons and nights after school for 2 weeks with that group of students. But it was really nice to be proven wrong in your impression of someone.
Zion was one of those kids.
I helped put the stain on the coffin and helped with some of the interior work, you know. And I feel like that kind of filled a hole, you know, that when I seen people come together, I feel like that made it easier and it made it okay, you know, to where we started to accept what happened actually as a school, so, you know.
What was your motivation in coming in?
My motivation, there's a couple factors. One, that he was in the Marines and that he didn't get to serve out his time, just to show respect to him. Mm-hmm. And then the fact that when I seen everybody get together, like Taylor and everybody, and they was all like, hey, let's help build this casket, I was like, shoot, I want to be a part of that, you know? Yeah.
That was interesting you'd mentioned Taylor, because Taylor was flunking my class, basically, because he never came to class before that happened. And he was probably the guy that you and Taylor were probably the two that helped the most on that whole project. And your grade wasn't in really good shape either at that time. I'd come up and I'd have little fireside chats with you and say, hey, you got to wake up or you're going to be so far behind, you're never going to catch up. I don't want to sound like I'm all judgmental, but I am. You know, teachers are judgmental. It's our job to be judgmental. So it was really nice to see them as caring, you know, concerned people that before had come off like, I don't give much of a shit about anything.
The coffin was made of wood. A cross was made for the top. Students and teachers wrote messages to Ryan on the coffin's lid inside.
What did you write inside?
I don't even remember. I probably said something like, I love you, Ryan.
This was the fifth coffin Mike has made for staff and students in his 25 years at Franklin. Two for people who worked at the school, and three for kids.
Student coffins are the hardest, you know, because they shouldn't happen.
So this was the third student. What were the, do you remember the situations for the other two?
One was basically an assassination. He was, lived right down the road, and he had a ground floor apartment. Somebody came up and on his window at night, and Johnny went over to find out who it was, and they, right on the other side of the window, they just shot him. And then the other was a suicide. A kid, a really great kid, another one of my students. All three of the people, the students we've made them for, have been kids that I had.
The student who committed suicide was a dreamer. His mother brought him to the U.S. undocumented when he was a small child.
And his mother got in trouble, and even during Obama's term and as president, they were trying to deport him because his mother got in trouble with the law, and he had married his high school sweetheart, and they just had a baby, and they were going through with trying to deport him. And I don't know, 2 weeks or something before they deported him, he committed suicide. And that one probably pisses me off the most, because that just, well, they all piss me off.
You know, I just want to say thank you for standing up and helping out and for doing that for him so his parents didn't have to, you know, come out of pocket, you know, and pay an extreme amount for something that you shouldn't have to pay an extreme amount for.
That's what I try to teach you guys, is that whatever it is, whether it's carpentry or woodworking or whatever it is, anything that you can do to be altruistic, I've said that word often in this class, to selflessly give others, selflessly, not selfishly, selflessly to give to others. So there's nothing in it for you. You know, it's hard enough losing someone when you feel like you can't do anything about it. That makes it worse. And you guys, I don't know if you even realized it at the time, but you were kind of channeling probably a lot of that anxiety that you were feeling into putting something out that spoke to the fact that you cared about Ryan and his family. So that's pretty cool. When you can do that, always take advantage of those situations.
I think this is going to help me live my life better, you know, instead of living my life day to day, you know, like how a lot of kids do in high school. I'm going to start thinking about plans more. I'm going to start doing things, because at any moment, you know, anything can happen. You know, you could be walking and then you just get shot. You know what I'm saying? Like, that means at any moment, if it happened to Ryan, it could happen to anybody. You know, just one day you're just chilling in them, you know? So I feel like we just got to live our best lives.
A few days after Ryan's murder, the students at Franklin High School held a protest. They marched outside of the building and down to Rainier Avenue holding signs, some of which said, protect kids, not guns, and not one more.
That story from Sound Effects, Jennifer Wing. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. This is Sound Effect. And today we're asking the question, what is normal? Some people try their hardest to fit in, but others, well, they just don't seem to care at all. Well, Dave Groh falls into that second category, which is pretty obvious to anyone who's ever taken a ride in his taxi.
People come walking up. They just called for a regular cab. I pull up, and they come walking out, hit the button, the door slides open, lights come on, the music's playing, and boom.
How would people react generally when they get in?
Well, very positively. You know, they'd smile, they'd laugh. Sometimes they'd immediately want me to start singing a song, which is why I put the karaoke system in, because I'm a terrible singer, and I've got to drive. Everybody, let's rock. Yeah, everybody in the wholesale block was dance to the jailhouse rock. It just charges the batteries when people are so overjoyed by something they didn't expect, a pleasant experience. Even when I was not with passengers inside, just driving along and people seeing, oh my God, that guy's dressed like Elvis Presley. Bus drivers, garbage men, just people in traffic, you know, like they're overjoyed to see something a little off, a little beyond the norm.
Dave's alter ego is Cab Elvis. And this is not a man for half measures. We're talking about dyed black hair, combed back, fancy jumpsuits, white boots, and a gaudy ring that would be the envy of the king himself.
It was actually, I think it was part of an old chandelier somebody had built into a ring. And it was this huge diamond, and it was actually labeled the Hopeless Diamond. And that became my centerpiece of attention for the costume.
As Dave and I drive around Seattle on a gray, rainy day, he tells me all this started back in 1999. Dave was working as a cab driver, and he tried out a new hairstyle.
For the first time in my life, I had the opportunity to grow out some facial hair. I was always told, you know, keep it clean, keep it neat, shave, do this, do that. So I had developed some chops.
And despite being a terrible singer, Dave liked to hang out at a particular karaoke bar in Seattle. One night he asked a friend who was a waitress there,
what song should I butcher tonight? And she suggested that I sing an Elvis Presley song because of the chops. And I got up there and ruined Return to Sender. And then another one of the workers there, she suggested that I try the Elvis costume for Halloween and actually went with me to Champions when he used to be on Denny there. And I put on the Elvis Presley costume in the back room, came walking out into the main lobby, and it was obvious that it was a good fit because everybody was just, wow, oh my gosh, that looks so great. And I drove the taxi that weekend with my Elvis costume on. Made mad tips. It's gratuities can come in more forms than just cash. Turns out that one lady that was standing in front of the doghouse, I think is where she often stood around, as I dropped off some passengers. Do you remember the doghouse?
That's a tavern of some kind?
It's a legendary watering hole, 24-hour diner, throwback to the 50s, greasy spoon type of place that became the Hurricane Cafe. But so Regina got in my cab in front of the doghouse and proceeded to ask for a ride to 85th and Aurora, another place she liked to stand around, and showed her appreciation along the way, if you know what I mean.
On the way.
Yeah.
Do I need to put a fine point on this? Well, okay, if you missed it, the appreciation or mad tip often came in the form of a sexual favor.
And so that was it's kind of what cemented my decision to wear the Elvis costume as much as I could.
So, wait a second, you're like, this is the reaction that I get, I'm doing this all the time?
Yeah, you find something that's working, and you say, okay, I'm going to do this, even though I knew that there were regulations against it.
And no, he's not talking about regulations against naughtiness with the customer. What he means is a dress code. See, at the time, cab drivers in Seattle had to wear a uniform. It was black pants and a blue shirt with a collar. The city fined Dave for breaking the rules. So he decided to sue, and in response, the Seattle City Council passed a law that allows cab drivers to dress up as celebrities, within reason. So if you see somebody driving for hire dressed as Billy Idol or Cher, well, you have Dave to thank. When all this started, Dave didn't actually know that much about Elvis Presley. Customers knew more about him than Dave did, so he realized that he needed to do some research.
And fortunately, I love to read. I'm a voracious reader. I always have been. And I learned his story. If it's worth doing, it's worth doing completely. I made the pilgrimage to Graceland, and now I am just a huge Elvis Presley fan. I am aware that, you know, some of his abnormal personality traits are what made him a superstar.
What is it in you that makes you the kind of person that would go out on a limb and do this and go all the way? Like, tell me a little bit about Dave Grohe, who and the personality traits you think that set the stage for this part of your life.
Of the positions that you take 20 guys and put them together for the first time, you're going to have a few minutes of trying to figure out who's going to be the alpha, who's going to be just one of the pack members and try not to be noticed too much, and who's going to be the runt, which I prefer to think of as the jester. So you've got the king, you've got his court, and you've got the jester. I'm the jester. I will be the one that gets you in trouble. I instigate the stuff. I've always been the one to willing to break the rules and suffer the consequences.
Did you feel like you were becoming closer to Elvis Presley? I mean, that you were realizing him in some way?
It felt like more I was channeling than I was impersonating at times. I'd get too deep into it. I think that one of the downfalls was that if people have drugs in their pocket and they're with somebody that reminds them of Elvis, they want to do drugs with the king. And I started, you know, just taking the occasional puff on a joint with passengers, which was fine. You know, I could still drive safely. The next passengers that got in the car didn't understand why I couldn't find the space needle. The occasional bump was offered and gratefully accepted.
Bumps, cocaine?
Yeah. I was smoking crack. I was doing that instead of working. I have said a couple of times it was the dark side of Elvis, but, you know, I realize I'm introspective enough to know that I didn't need the king to do that. It just made it more available, more socially acceptable. I think people were like, oh, yeah, let's do some drugs with Elvis Presley. I'm sure I'm not the only one that found it easier to get lucky because you're more out there, more willing to step out of your own character and portray someone who's more confident and sexy than you probably think you are on your own self.
This life almost killed Dave. To save himself, he moved to Hawaii for a few years, and that's where he got sober and met his wife. Life was good there, but it was really expensive, so they moved back to Seattle. As he drives me around, Dave is not dressed in the Elvis getup, and we're not in a cab. We're just in his own car. These days, Dave makes his living driving a tour bus around Seattle instead of a taxi. See, when Dave moved back here in 2015, cabs were suddenly sharing the road with Uber and Lyft drivers, and people didn't want to wait for Cab Elvis anymore.
It reached a point where it was just too simple to touch the phone and your ride is there in 3 minutes.
And Elvis, well, he started to steal the show. People didn't want to pay Dave to take them somewhere. They just wanted to see the king.
I had people that would get into kind of a bet in a bar. They'd be like, hey, man, I bet you I can get Elvis Presley to walk in this bar in 10 minutes. And people like, yeah, right. And they'd call me up and say, hey, Dave, come get me at the rendezvous. And I'd pull up, stand there, say, I don't see anybody. Just go inside, hey. And they're like, hey, there's Elvis. And they didn't really want to go anywhere.
Oh, so they wouldn't even take a ride.
They wouldn't even take a ride. They just wanted to prove they could summon Elvis Presley.
So you were kind of a victim of your own success in some ways, it seems like.
I think that's you know, what the old nobody goes there anymore. It's too crowded.
What would you say you have learned from being Elvis?
What I have learned from putting on the Elvis Presley costume is that if you have a way to spread some joy in the world, if you can make people smile and it doesn't cost you anything, why in the world shouldn't you do it? Take the chance. Somebody tells you no, you're not allowed to do that. Say why. Question authority. Question the rules. Do what brings you joy. And if it brings joy to other people, if that's what brings you joy, then do it.
That's Dave Grohe, also known as Cab Elvis. While he doesn't channel the King full-time these days, the spirit of Elvis peeks through. He's still got the chops, the aviator glasses, and the attitude. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Ashley Ahern and Paul Currington. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. Our podcast drops twice a week these days, most of the time. Get behind-the-scenes takes and extra content when you subscribe. You can find us in all the usual places, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, NPR One. You can also ask your smart speaker to play Sound Effect, the podcast. Send your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. We really do love to hear from you. And tune in next week when our theme is Imperfect Crime. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.